Module 9, Buying, Selling, Negotiation and Options. The process of buying and selling a property is often taken for granted. It is not until you are actually going through the process that you realize just how many aspects there are to consider and in fact how many decisions need to be made. Certainly, buying and selling can be a very stressful situation, as a lot has to happen in a relatively short period of time. Therefore, the more prepared you are in advance, the more comfortable and confident you will be in the process. In this module, we work through the various components to consider when both buying and selling, from dealing with agents, making and receiving offers, the contract process, right through to settlement. Negotiation is another huge component in the process of buying and selling property, and in fact in dealing with people in general. Your capacity to negotiate and to influence other people's decisions, opinions, and actions can be very powerful and should not be underestimated. For those people that may not consider themselves to be natural negotiators, you are in luck because these are skills that can be learned. There are principles to negotiation and tips and tricks, and these will be detailed in the negotiation section of this module. A different method of buying and selling property is through an option agreement. Options are an invaluable tool in your investment toolbox and a technique that will be covered in detail at the end of this module. The different types of options will be outlined, the documentation involved will be gone through, the negotiation process involved in this type of agreement, and again the tips and tricks to give you confidence in using this tool in your investing journey. Buying. When buying a property, there are many aspects to consider. There is also a lot at stake, typically being in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. For this reason, it is essential that you are familiar with the process, the questions to ask, the options to consider, and the decisions to be made as detailed below. Buying methods. There are a number of methods that can be used when buying a property, depending on whether the property is on the market or off the market, as outlined below. 1. On the market property. Property that is listed for sale is on the market. It is either listed for sale by a licensed real estate agent or is being sold directly by the owners through private sale situation. Real estate agent listing. When a property is listed by an agent, the agent is being paid by the seller and so is working for the seller. Your job is to build relationships with local agents so that they come to understand that you are a serious buyer and that you are actively in the market and ready to buy. This includes calling them on a regular basis to show that you are genuine. Note in your diary to contact them every week or two so that if a new listing comes up, your name is the first that comes to their mind and they call you first. This is all about building rapport. If they contact you about a property, but it's not the right property for you, give them the courtesy of providing them feedback and tell them why it wasn't right. Maybe it wasn't in the right area, not the right configuration, the right land size, the right zoning. Whatever it is, let them know so that they are better informed about what it is that you actually want. If the numbers don't stack up and the asking price is too high for the strategy you are proposing, this is also great feedback to provide the agent, especially if it's a property being advertised with development potential. In fact, this can be a great negotiation technique because by explaining the numbers to the agent and even the owner, if you can get access to them, you are first showing them that you are serious, but you are also educating the agent and the owner why it may not be selling, and this can work in your favour. Certainly, if the property has been on the market for a long time, this can be a great strategy and provide you with the negotiating ammunition you need. Non-local real estate agent listing. Properties that are listed for sale by an agent that is not local to the area where the property is located are classed as a non-local agent property. The reason that this is relevant is because if they are not local to the area, they may not truly know the prices in the area or the potential of the area. They may not know that the property is in fact a zoning or land size that could be developed, or they may not know that the market is actually moving quickly or that major redevelopment is planned nearby, and hence they may price the property below its actual value. Certainly when you see a non-local agent listing, it's definitely worth further investigation for those reasons. Also, the agent may not be motivated to travel a distance to do open houses or to do an inspection, and so sometimes they price the property for a quick sale. Certainly the size of the town influences whether an agent is local or not. For example, In a metro location, an agent may be classed as non-local if they are a few suburbs away, whereas when it's in a smaller location, the agent may need to be from a different town to be classed as non-local. At the end of the day, it's about you being an area expert and understanding the market that you are focused on, so that you can identify an opportunity when it presents itself. Buyer's agent. A buyer's agent is a real estate agent that is working for you, the buyer, to find a property that meets your specific criteria. You engage them directly and pay them for their services, generally as a percentage on settlement, but often there is also an upfront fee portion too. For those people with less time, less experience, or who are not local to the area, a buyer's agent can be a great alternative, just as long as you have factored in their cost into the deal and your feasibility. A buyer's agent will typically negotiate on your behalf, and that can sometimes be an added benefit depending on your level of experience. Marketers. Marketers are a form of real estate agent, but rather than having a shop front like a typical real estate agent, they are generally more virtual and they are typically getting access to property at a discounted rate, adding a substantial commission and then marketing it for sale on behalf of the developer. They often sell off the planned property that has not yet been developed, or house and land packages where the land is not yet through titles, but also they market the finished end product, depending on at what stage the developer wants it sold. Generally, it's brand new property rather than second-hand that they sell. Marketers may be individual real estate agents or larger businesses, and they generally sell the property direct to the public. These are the companies that cold call people to sell them a property over the phone. Also, professionals like accountants and financial advisors may source properties for their clients from marketers. They will often provide a full service, including finance for the purchase, legals, and even property management. Know that you are potentially paying above market price if you are buying from a marketer. Specialist real estate agent. For specialist real estate, there are specialist agents. Commercial property is an example of this, where it may be sold by the local residential real estate agent, or it may be sold by a specialist commercial real estate agent. Even within commercial agents, there are specialists that only sell certain types of commercial property, like tourism property, for example, caravan parks or motels, and others that only sell childcare centres, or those that specialise in selling larger developmental sites. Often business real estate, where the business and the property are being sold together, are marketed by specialist agents. Rent-to-buy residential properties can also be marketed by specialist agents that understand that particular industry. Private owner listing. Properties listed for sale directly by the owner are called private sales. There are many designated websites dedicated to the sale of properties by owners, including noagentproperty.com.au, buymyplace.com.au, owner.com.au, to name a few. Other general websites like Gumtree, Trading Post and eBay have privately listed properties advertised. The benefit of buying direct from the owner is that you are dealing directly with the decision maker, which in some instances can make the negotiation easier. In other situations, though, a private listing can be a challenge because the owner is emotionally attached to their property and often value it higher than market value. Public trustee listings. The public trustee sells properties on behalf of their clients. They are based in each state and generally list properties per region. They conduct auctions and have for sale listed properties and are always worth researching because they are lesser known sources of properties. 2. Off-market property. Property that is not listed for sale is classed as off the market, but this does not mean that, if approached, the owner may not be willing to consider selling. For this reason, off-market property is where real deals are made because they are not in the public domain and not subject to the competition that can surround properties listed for sale on the open market. For owners that are open to the idea of selling, they may be more negotiable with terms. Because they were not necessarily planning to move straight away, they are often more open to longer settlement periods and potentially due diligence clauses to give you the right and the time to search at the potential of the property. They may also be more negotiable on price because a real estate agent isn't involved and hence commission is not payable. Obviously, these are just general statements and each owner's circumstances are different, and that's where your skill as a negotiator comes into play. There is just one other comment regarding sale price that needs to be made. Do not assume that you are going to buy substantially below market value when negotiating off-market property. This is because there is a good chance that the first phone call the owner will make once you walk out that door is to a real estate agent to get a market appraisal on their property. Building trust is important when negotiating an off-market deal. So if you have told them the property was worth substantially less than the real estate market value, you may jeopardize the negotiation. In saying that, not everyone is driven by price. And so you need to understand the needs of the owner, seller, when doing this type of negotiation. Purchasing a property off market is a much more active process than for property on the market, because you or your team need to approach owners directly. This is not an approach that can generally be done from behind the computer. You need to get out and about and start having conversations. Certainly, looking for telltale signs of a property in disrepair or poorly maintained or with overgrown gardens may be a sign that the property is getting too much for the owner to maintain, or the investor may have lost interest, or may have the tenants from hell, or may be a long distance away and be unaware of its state. These are all potential reasons why people may be open to selling. An old real estate agent's sign fallen over or lying to one side on the property is another telltale sign to look out for and may suggest that the property has been on the market a long time and that the agent has lost interest in it. That's a great opportunity to then contact the owner directly. Below are a number of methods for buying property off market. Letterbox drop. Writing a personal letter to a homeowner and either putting it directly into their letterbox or posting it to them is a method to flush out those owners that are willing to consider selling their property. This can be either done on a very selective basis, where you have already researched the properties and are targeting specific properties, or the alternative method is where you are letterbox dropping to all of the houses in the street or in an area that you have identified as being of interest. For example, these may be streets in the right zoning for what you are looking for. This is clearly a much more scattergun approach and may result in properties that don't fit your other criteria. However, a lead is a lead, and you just never know where that conversation may take you. Certainly, the letter that you write should be written in such a way that it grabs the owner's attention and encourages them to contact you to find out more. It is best to be handwritten in an envelope, and it should be on quality paper that is light blue or purple, because that gets the owner's attention like an invitation to a party. These little tricks will give you a greater chance that they will open and read the letter. Door knocking. When you approach an owner directly and start up a conversation, this is referred to as door knocking. Remember that it may also be a conversation at the letterbox while you are walking past, or you may see the owner in the garden and stop for a chat. The key to this approach is confidence. And the way to create confidence, if you are not naturally so, is to spend time preparing. Prepare for how you might start them lead into the conversation and how you might answer the likely questions they will have for you. Again, building rapport is key. Referrals. Talking to your family, friends, colleagues, and your team about the type of property that you are interested in can yield surprising results, and do not underestimate tradespeople. Your plumber, electrician, painter, and even the local hairdresser. They themselves have a wide network of clients and contacts and may just know that Mrs. Smith is considering selling but just hasn't put her property on the market yet. Or Mr. Jones has just been talking about the area becoming too busy for him. These are all potential opportunities to follow up. It may turn out that Mrs. Smith's property isn't quite right for your needs, but she might know that Mary down the street has a larger block and may be interested in selling sometime soon. It's all about having conversations, which means getting out from behind the computer. Real estate buyer's agent. Using real estate agents and having them work specifically for you is another method. Agents have a network of owners that they know that may be interested in selling. For example, maybe the owners previously had their property on the market but it didn't sell, so they took it off the market. The agent knows that they may still be a willing seller and could approach them on your behalf. Alternatively, the agent can door knock properties that specifically meet your criteria, as can a buyer's agent, again flushing out a potential sale. Agents with in-house property management services could also contact their database of investors to identify if anyone is willing to sell their investment property. Buying off-market is only limited by your imagination. Sourcing property deals. Sourcing leads to properties of potential interest is likely to involve a combination of the different strategies outlined above for on-market and off-market properties. These include: have alerts on property websites to alert you when a new listing comes online, for example, realestate.com, domain, investor, etc. Schedule these alerts to inform you as soon as the listing is made is very important to ensure you don't miss anything. Also, checking these on a regular basis is important because a new listing may come through in the night, and if you pick up on it quickly enough and you have done your review of the deal, you can be the first on the phone in the morning and have inspected the property and put in an offer before others are even getting to look at the email alert. This is how proactive you need to be in order to get the good deals, because they won't sit around for long. For those websites where alerts can't be set up, schedule in your diary to manually check them on a regular basis. Create mates in the market with local real estate agents that will bring you deals before they list them to the open market. Putting in the effort to cultivate these relationships is essential. Calling the agent every week to just touch base can be a great way to do this. Don't hesitate to take them out for coffee either, in order to explain to them exactly what it is that you are looking for. Remember, relationships, relationships, relationships. Some agents are also very active on social media and will put information on new property on Facebook or Twitter, etc., before it's actually listed on the agency website. Follow these agents on social media. Engage a buyer's agent to source properties specifically for you, both on and off the market, or working with a listing agent that will unearth deals just for you. Undertake door knocking and letterbox dropping activities yourself, or pay someone to do it for you. Leverage off your referral network and spread the word amongst them, including family, friends, tradespeople, etc. Incentivize the process for them and make it known that you are prepared to pay a referral fee, say $2,000 for a lead that someone provides you that results in you purchasing the property. Network with like-minded people and make it known that you will pay a spotter's fee for a deal that someone else may identify and pass on to you. Lots of people come across deals that they are not in a position to act on for whatever reason, and they may be willing to pass them on to you. Typically, you only pay the fee if you proceed to purchase the property. But again, this can be a great way to attract deals your way. The I Love Real Estate community and Success Accelerator Mastermind community are perfect examples of this, as are other property meetups and property networking groups. Cultivate potential joint venture relationships if that is part of your strategy, so that the JV partner or partners bring you potential deals. Sourcing deals is really only limited by your imagination and your willingness to get out there and make it happen. Questions to ask. Assuming that you have narrowed down your search to a property listed for sale by a real estate agent, there are a series of questions that you should ask the agent. The aim is to get as much information about the property and about the sellers from this and subsequent conversations, because the more information you have, the more able you are to tailor an offer to the seller's needs, assuming you get to the stage of making an offer. This shouldn't be an interrogation of the agent, but instead you want to build rapport, because the more friendly you can become with the agent, the more information you are likely to get from them. Let's face it, a real estate agent is generally a people person and someone who likes to talk. So the more comfortable you can make them feel and the more talkative you can get them to be, the more information you are likely to get. Information leakage, where the agent tells you more than what they really should have about the seller and a property, is not uncommon and is something you want to be mindful of and encourage when the opportunity presents. Ask the agent open questions that can facilitate the conversation. The following list is not exhaustive, but certainly contains the key questions to ask. How long has the property been on the market? Was the property listed for sale previously by another agent? Why is the owner selling? How long has the seller owned the property? Is the owner negotiable on price? Is the owner negotiable on the terms of the contract? Have offers been submitted? What were they and what was the owner's response? If the property is tenanted, what rent is being paid? What's the duration of the lease? And is it being sold with vacant possession? How long has a tenant lived there? Who is the tenant? Do they work, pets, etc., etc.? Who is the property manager? How long has the manager had it? How long has it been a rental property? What is the rental history? If the property is being sold with a development approval, request a copy of the DA, conditions and approved plans. Ask for a copy of the owner's feasibility on the deal, because if they have got a DA, they hopefully also did a feasibility. Talk to the agent about the demand for the end product, recognising that the selling agent will be biased and will tell you what you want to hear, because they will want to sell you the property. All of this research needs to be reviewed during your due diligence on the property, as detailed later in this module. If you get resistance from the agent in answering these questions, then maybe you need to remind them that the more they can help you to understand the property and the owner's position better, the more you can help them by buying the property. It's a win-win situation. If you are just starting out and you are not comfortable making a phone call to an agent, the best idea is to spend time in advance writing out your questions and preparing and writing some answers to questions that the agent may ask you. This is because the more prepared you can be, the more confident you will be too. The questions they may ask you are, have you been looking long? Are you ready to buy? Have you got it financed pre-approved? Have you looked at other property in the area? What is your budget? Have you done a development project before? Do you live locally? When can you inspect the property? If you are still not confident, then do a dummy run calling an agent in a completely different area about a property that you really have no interest in or intention to follow through with. By talking with an agent that you are unlikely to talk to ever again, at least if you fumble your way through, it won't matter. In fact, make these calls over and over if that's what it takes to get you comfortable in the process. Remember, it's over the phone. They don't actually know who you are. It's guaranteed that after you have done this, you will feel much more confident in making the call to the real estate agent about the real property you are interested in. In fact, you will probably surprise yourself that it wasn't as hard as what you had expected. A word of caution when contacting real estate agents is if you are serious about a property, do not send an email inquiry to the agent. You need to understand that real estate agents get so many emails that yours can easily be lost in the pile. Always pick up the phone and call them directly. If their mobile goes to message, leave one and send a text too. Then follow up by phoning their office. And if you can't get through to them that way, then ask to talk to another agent in the office about the property. Sometimes you just have to hound them down to get a response. Remember, the squeaky wheel gets the attention. If there are two agents listed on a property and you don't get a response from the first one you call, then definitely contact the second agent. If you fail to get any joy from the two of them after a day, you could contact the principal of the agency or a competitor agent in another agency, as they are likely to know the property if they are an expert in their area, and you just never know, they may know the property owner or be able to conjunct with the current listing agent. But more on that later in the module. Desktop review. With any property that you are interested in, there is a lot of research that can be done from your desktop prior to physically inspecting a property. This research is the start of your due diligence on the property. The more prepared you can be prior to the inspection, the more information you will be able to capture during the inspection. For example, if you were looking at a property for its subdivision potential, the initial research might include: view the property on Google Earth and Street View to confirm such things as the existing house position on the land, the ease of access to the vacant area of land, any significant features on the land, the slope of the land, the characteristics of adjoining properties, the lot sizes in the surrounding area, evidence of activity in the area, for example, subdivision, building works, duplex and multi-unit developments, location of the power lines and poles, infrastructure out the front of the property, the nature of the road corridor, proximity to public transport, infrastructure, etc. Confirm the land size, area and dimensions on RP Data or PS Live or My Valuer or Investar. Doing a scale drawing from the aerial photos and the dimension information can allow you to do a rough calculation of the balanced land available and dimensions, and hence allow you to consider the opportunities with the site. Assess the ownership history of the property on RP Data or PS Live or My Valuer or Investar, as this will give you insight into the owner and what their situation may be. Information of relevance includes owner details, for example, personal name or company, trust, if the owner's address is the same as the property and hence if they are owner-occupier, if the property is tenanted, when the property was purchased, what was the purchase price, how long has the property been listed for sale, has only one agent listed it, or have they changed agents over the time, has it been listed for rent, at what price and through what agency. Depending on your state, you may be able to do a search based on the owner's name, which will bring up any other properties they own. This is very insightful because negotiating with someone who owns multiple properties can be different from negotiating with someone who owns only one property, and you are better off knowing this information up front. Also, review all photos of the property because often older photos are included, and you can get a lot of information from seeing how the property has changed over time. Do a radial search on RP Data, PDS Live or My Valuer, etc. to identify some properties in the street, neighbouring streets and the general area. Knowing what other properties have sold for based on their house configuration, land size and sale date is very informative. Review comparable sales for the end product that you propose to produce. For example, renovated existing house on smaller subdivided block, subdivided vacant land, and also newly built house on subdivided land. Obviously, this is the best case scenario if you can compile comparable sales on the exact same end products, but sometimes we need to be less specific. Review current rental prices and availability for the existing product, for example, unrenovated three-bedroom house, and the product you are proposing to create, for example, renovated three-bedroom house on smaller subdivided lot size. Research the land zoning of the property using the council website Town Planning Zoning Maps or the equivalent tool in your state. Even if your strategy does not involve zonings, for example a renovation deal, you should still research the site zoning as it may open up alternatives that you had not previously considered. The zoning may also influence the price of the property, and this is important to understand and take into account. Research council overlays that may impact on the property, such as flooding, overland flow, native vegetation, heritage, demolition control, streetscape significance, slope, slip prone, bushfire prone, road hierarchy, etc., etc. This information can be invaluable to identify any constraints with the site that may impact on its potential. Conduct a dial before you dig search on the property to identify the location of services, power, water, sewer, stormwater, phone, gas, if this is relevant to your strategy. Property inspection. A word of caution. It is not recommended that you purchase a property without physically inspecting it first. Taking the agent's word for things or relying on photos is potentially very dangerous. Things can be very different in reality. The neighbours may be the neighbours from hell, or the area may be less than desirable, and this can have a huge impact on the value of the property. Certainly, when there are often hundreds of thousands of dollars on the line in purchasing a property, this is not the time to penny pinch. In fact, if you are not prepared to spend the cost to inspect the property, you should not be in the market to buy. Okay, with that now said, let's get into the practicalities of inspecting. As with each of the previous stages, once you are at the point of physically inspecting a property, the more prepared you can be for the inspection, the more quality information you will come away with. Whether this information is gathered at the first inspection or over a couple of visits will depend on your urgency to make a decision on the deal and to submit a purchase offer. The key to inspecting property is not to give too much away to the agent, the owners, and in fact anyone else at the property. Keep your poker face on, so to speak. Even if it looks to be fantastic, don't talk the property up to the agent or in front of the owner. Just keep your cool and keep a check on your excitement. Also, do not give your game plan away to the agent. For example, your plan to develop the site. Sometimes this can be difficult because on the one hand, you want to extract information out of the agent in terms of the market and potential to sell the end product. Yet on the other hand, you don't want to give the agent any new ideas. This is because they will then use your good ideas and tell the next person inspecting the property. Remember, the agent's job is to get it sold, and they are likely to do whatever it takes to make that happen. So certainly keep your cards close to your chest. Obviously, if the agent brought the deal to you because they knew you were wanting a deal with development potential, then they will know your general intention. You don't have to expand on this, though, or tell them exactly how many units you think you could fit, or how many rooms you are looking to rent out, or how many blocks you think you can subdivide off. In reality, you need to take the listing agent's feedback on the market and on the potential of the end product with a grain of salt, because their primary motivation is to sell the property, and they are likely to talk things up. Instead, you should be directing these same questions to the other agents in the area who don't have a vested interest in the property and who are likely to be much more honest in their response. Certainly, once you have secured the property and taken it off the market, you can be very specific with the other agents, to the point of telling them the address of your property and asking what that site would sell for if you did strategy XYZ. If you plan to undertake a renovation of the property, having your renovation checklist at the inspection and filling it out room by room is important. Also, noting the general condition of the property inside and out, even if you don't intend to renovate, can be very useful. You can easily forget things once you leave the property, things like whether it had fans in the bedrooms and if they need replacing, or whether they had built-in robes or not. You would be surprised at how easily you forget these details, particularly when you are looking at several properties at a time. Taking your development due diligence checklist and your desktop review information to the inspection and looking at the property, the site, and the surroundings objectively is also vital. Things to consider are actually focusing on the frontage of the property and looking for any street signs, power poles, no parking areas, street trees, etc. Standing along the boundary to see if there are potential encroachment issues. Confirming the slope and lie of the land by looking at the land and using telltale signs like retaining walls and the footings of built structures. Confirming the location of services and the position of the water meter, Telstra pit, sewer manholes, stormwater pipe outlets, etc. Noting unexpected features on site like concrete slabs, asbestos materials, and the like. Take your tape measure with you and confirm on site the dimensions you estimated during the desktop review process, including the site frontage, access driveway width, etc. This will not be as exact as a site survey, but will be more accurate than the scaling you did from the aerial photos. Last but not least, take lots of photographs. Again, this helps hugely with capturing things that you just may not have noted at the time. You can't ever take too many photos and from different perspectives. It is a great resource to come back to if you can't easily get back to the site or into the property. If the owner or tenant is at the property, try to engage in conversation with them. It's amazing sometimes what extra information you can gain from this. For example, the tenant may tell you the issues with the neighbour, or the maintenance problems with the property, or the owner may divulge information that gives you a better understanding of their intentions and their motivation to sell and their time frame to leave. Try to keep quiet and just listen, as there can be pearls of information that can come from these transactions. Due diligence. In the sections above, conducting due diligence on the property and on the deal has been touched on. This research is not to be underestimated, as it can absolutely make or break a deal. Some of the due diligence you will complete during your desktop review prior to inspecting. Some will be done at the inspections. And the balance should be done during the conditional period once you have a contract on the property. What is essential is that your due diligence is complete by the time when you have to go unconditional on the purchase, because beyond that point, there is no getting out of the deal easily. The due diligence that should be conducted includes due diligence on the property, see the second half of Module 7, the area, see the second half of Module 7, strategy or strategies that you are proposing to undertake, process, time frame, team involved, etc. Financing, see the first half of Module 8, ownership entity that you propose to use to purchase in, ensuring it is ready to go and signatories are available. Purchase price, using comparable sales data, talking to agents and even valuers. End product value, rental, demand, using comparable sales data, talking to agents and valuers. Feasibility and all costs to do the deal, see Module 6. Approvals being sold with the property, such as development approval, building approval, etc. Joint venture parties, if relevant, see the second half of Module 8. If the property is being sold at auction, you would want to have all of this due diligence complete before bidding, given that an auction is typically an unconditional contract at the fall of the hammer. When purchasing outside of auction, the point that you would make an offer and try to take the property off the market is dependent on the state the property is in. For example, in all states except New South Wales, the buyer can negotiate to have conditions in the contract, and those conditions first need to be fulfilled before the purchase is unconditional. Hence, the contract is subject to the successful fulfilment of the conditions, for example, securing finance, acceptable building and pest inspection, etc. In these states, you may therefore choose to make an offer and put a contract on a property sooner rather than later. This will effectively buy yourself some time to complete your due diligence in the confidence that you have the property tied up for a period of time and no one else can buy it and take the deal from you over that period. Clearly, this is advantageous as it gives you extra time to complete your due diligence. In New South Wales, the law is different, and making an offer and even entering a contract does not give you exclusivity to the property. It is only after the contract is exchanged that you have it tied up. However, unlike the other states, at that point it is an unconditional contract. The timing of when you can complete your due diligence is therefore much more restrictive, and generally it needs to be completed before you exchange contracts. The issue with this is that while you are doing your due diligence, someone else may buy the property from beneath you. The good news is that there are potential ways around this, as outlined in more detail in the contract section below. However, they are not regularly used in the market by the general public and so are less well understood by sellers and agents. The reason this is relevant at this point is because it does affect the timing of your due diligence with New South Wales properties. Making an offer. Making an offer to purchase a property is always a very exciting time. It can be a little stressful too, though, as lots of decisions often need to be made in a short space of time. So once again, there are definitely benefits to being prepared leading into this stage. 1. Solicitor involvement. A major part of being prepared is to have had discussions with your solicitor well in advance. Items that you should cover include understanding the contract process in your state, your intention with the property and your thoughts regarding conditional clauses, the need to have clauses pre-drafted by your solicitor so that you have them at your ready to include in your offer, for example, due diligence, early access, owner to sign applications, etc. Do not underestimate the value in having these on hand ahead of schedule. The purchasing entity and the exact name that should be reflected in your offer to go on the contract. Confirming who can actually sign the contract and whether other instruments like a power of attorney needs to be put in place in advance. Joint venture arrangement. It is guaranteed that your solicitor will be over the moon with you contacting them and being proactive about this stage, rather than you calling them at 5 p.m. Friday afternoon, desperate for them to write you clauses to put in an offer on something that they previously knew nothing about. 2. Contract terms. Constructing your offer and being very clear on what it is that you want in the deal is very important, and you should spend time up front thinking this over and writing it down. The decisions that you need to make in order to construct your offer ultimately become terms of the contract. When you negotiate the offer with the owner, it is these terms that you are negotiating on. In the excitement of the negotiation process, and for some people in the stress of the negotiation process, there is potential for you to agree to something you may regret in the future. That is why it is invaluable to have already thought about each term, what your position is, and what you are prepared to negotiate on, and to what extent. The contract terms include purchase price, the total amount of money you are offering to pay for the property, the deposit amount, the amount of money that you are prepared to pay to secure the property. There is no set figure, although some sellers still think that 5% or 10% of the purchase price is standard. As a buyer, however, your aim is to try to put down the least amount of deposit as possible, for example, $2,000, because it's held in trust and no longer at your disposal. The more deposit you are prepared to pay, though, the more serious your offer is generally perceived to be by the buyer. Timing of deposit payment. Typically, the deposit is paid when you make the purchase offer. Everything is negotiable, however, and the alternatives are to pay on countersigning the purchase contract, or paying a fraction on signing and the balance on unconditional. It is limited only by your imagination and capacity to negotiate. Contract period. The period of time until property settlement occurs and title is transferred to the new owner. This may be expressed as a certain number of days, for example 60 days, or as a specific date in the future. A 30-day contract period is typically the shortest, especially if a bank is involved, because it takes time for the bank to prepare for the ownership transfer. A long contract period is typically one that is 90 days or more. The seller's personal situation will dictate if a shorter or longer contract is more desirable to them. As a general rule, though, the shorter the contract period, the stronger the offer, especially when a property is on the market, because most people want their money sooner rather than later. Finance approval. A standard clause in most contracts is finance approval. This protects the purchaser to ensure that finance is approved for the purchase before it goes unconditional. You need to specify the duration of time you require to get finance approval, for example, 28 days. It takes time for the bank to engage a valuer and process your application, and so do not make the period too short, otherwise you are likely to have to request an extension. Talk to your mortgage broker in advance to determine the realistic time period for finance approval by your target bank. A trick that sometimes works is to specify business days, for example, 28 business days, and hence getting yourself more time than when based on calendar days. You also want to ensure that the finance approval is to the purchaser's satisfaction. The purchaser's satisfaction is very important because the only bank that may agree to finance the purchase may do it based on terms that are not to your approval, for example, very high interest rate or principal and interest payments or shorter than normal loan term. You want the discretion to decline this finance approval if need be, and hence be able to get out of the deal if necessary. Building and pest approval. Depending on your state, building and pest approval may also be a standard clause already written into the contract. If it is not, you need to consider adding it if there are built structures on the site that you intend to keep. You will need to specify the duration of this clause and hence the number of days that you have to get these inspections complete, for example, 7 or 14 days. Once again, the business days trick can work here too, and you definitely want to ensure that the inspection results are to your satisfaction. For example, if the building inspection reveals that the roof is in poor condition and needs major repair, and this will be outside of your budget, you want the option to be able to terminate the contract on this basis or go back and renegotiate. Vacant possession. You need to decide if you require the property to be vacant at settlement. If so, you want vacant possession. This is very relevant when the property is currently tenanted, because the tenant is entitled to remain in the property for the duration of their lease, and hence you may not get access to the property post-settlement. In this instance, the seller may need to negotiate with the tenant to break their lease. Alternatively, you may be buying the property because it has an existing tenant in place, in which case you do not want vacant possession and you want the tenant to stay on. If this is the case, the existence of a tenant should be noted on the contract, along with details of the rent amount, lease duration, and property manager if applicable. Personal chattels. Fixtures and fittings are all part of the purchase of a property. However, if you want to include in the purchase personal effects, then these need to be specified under the chattel section of the contract, for example, furniture, pool equipment, etc. The description of these items should be very specific to ensure that you don't get left with something similar, but not the exact item. A great example of this is with a ride-on lawnmower. You should specify the make, model, and year of the mower, and even include photos if possible. Otherwise, you may get a rude surprise at settlement and find that the seller has indeed left you with a ride-on mower, but it is much older and lower quality than the one you had seen on inspection. The seller may also choose to include chattels in the contract because it's more convenient for them to leave them there, for example, the piano. If you do not want these items or don't want the cost or hassle of disposing of them, then you need to remove them from the contract. Special conditions. Conditions that are included specifically for this contract are classed as special conditions. These definitely should be written by your solicitor and preferably prior to your making the offer. You want to provide the real estate agent with the wording, not relying on them to write the condition for you. This is because they are not working for you and may not have your best interest at heart. Also, they are not legally trained and hence what they have written may not hold up under legal scrutiny. Special conditions are limited only by your imagination. However, be aware that the more conditions you include in a contract, generally the less desirable your offer. Some conditions are time sensitive and you must include a time frame for fulfillment. For example, subject to satisfactory solicitor review, accountant review, due diligence, body corporate review for strata title property, soil test, survey, pool inspection, development approval, etc. Other special conditions are more of a general statement that all parties are agreeing to, for example, access on 3 occasions to take measurements and get quotes, works to be completed by seller, works to be undertaken by buyer prior to settlement, site to be cleared of all debris including dumped rubbish and car bodies, etc. Due diligence condition. The due diligence special condition is worthy of further explanation. This is a very useful clause because it is generally open-ended and states that the buyer can terminate the contract up to the period of time specified if they are not satisfied with their investigations into the property. This means if you find out that the zoning is not right for your strategy, or the town planner isn't confident of a council approval, or if the renovation works are going to be too expensive or involved, or if you can't find a joint venture party, or simply you change your mind, you have an out. So this is a very flexible condition that can give you time to complete your due diligence on the deal and be able to terminate for any reason. Be mindful, however, that some sellers and sellers' solicitors may be less accepting of this condition because it is so open-ended. Obviously, the shorter the due diligence period, the more palatable it is to the seller. For example, a 28-day due diligence clause that just happens to be aligned with the 28-day finance clause is not adversely inconveniencing the seller because the due diligence is not any longer than the finance period. In comparison, a 90-day due diligence clause may be less appealing because of the longer period of uncertainty. Keep this in mind when making your offer and during the negotiation process. As a general principle, the less conditions that you have in a contract, the stronger your offer is, and the more desirable it is to the seller. Hence, a cash, unconditional offer is a much stronger offer than one that requires finance approval or that has other conditions that need to be fulfilled before going unconditional. If you are offering a substantially lower purchase price, the general rule is that you have fewer conditions and the conditional time periods are kept shorter. Hence, you negotiate on price or terms, but generally not both. This is a very general statement, however, because in fact the seller may prefer a longer settlement. Also, the strength of the market has a bearing, because in a slower, weaker market where supply outstrips demand and sellers are much more motivated to negotiate, you would certainly look to negotiate on both price and terms. In contrast, in a hot market where demand is very high, you may have to offer above asking price to even have your offer considered. Presenting an offer. When you initially present an offer to purchase, it is likely that you would verbally tell the real estate agent face-to-face or over the phone. However, it is suggested that you follow this up in writing very soon thereafter, for example, an email, so that there is no misunderstanding. Also, this assists the agent to prepare the contract with the correct information. The relevant information that you want to include in writing includes the property address, your purchasing entity exactly as it needs to be written on the contract, your contact details, phone, email address, your solicitor's name and contact details, purchase price, contract period, deposit amount and when payable, finance condition and number of days, building and pest condition and number of days, special conditions, exact wording of the conditions. Depending on the nature of your offer, the agent may agree to discuss it with the seller, or they may try and dismiss it and suggest that that is too low or that the conditions are too onerous. In that situation, you may need to take a firm stance with the agent and remind them that they are legally bound to present all written offers to the seller. It is worth highlighting to the agent that you are looking at other properties and that your offer is not open-ended and is not on the table indefinitely. You may in fact take this to a step further and tell the agent that you are making offers on other properties at the same time and therefore you need a response sooner rather than later. This tactic is because you do not want your offer to sit around for days on end without a response, because it gives time for other buyers to become interested. Plus, it gives time for the agent to drum up new buyers if they think the seller is now considering your lower price and terms. It is just amazing sometimes how a property may have sat on the market for months on end, and then the day that you make an offer, another one or two buyers seem to come out of the woodwork and make offers too. Remember that the payment of the deposit amount may form part of your offer, depending on the payment terms you specified. If this is the case, you need to make active arrangements to pay the deposit to formalise and strengthen your offer. 4. Shotgun approach to making offers. There is strategy around the whole offer process, and for some people, they will choose to make an offer on one property at a time. At the other end of the spectrum is where you make offers on many properties at a time, and you offer significantly below market price in order to flush out those sellers that are highly motivated and thus negotiable. This approach is called the shotgun or scattergun approach and certainly suits some people's style and some strategies. For example, if you are looking to buy a regional cash cow property, putting in lots of lowball offers may be appropriate because it just comes down to the purchase price and the yield, and the lower you can get the purchase price, the higher the yield will be. The more particular you are about the property, its characteristics, and the location, the less likely you are going to be to take this scattergun approach to making offers. Multi-offer situation. A multiple offer situation is where more than one person has put a formal offer on a property within a very short period of time of each other. This can certainly happen in a strong market where demand is very high, or where a unique property has just come on the market. If the seller has not yet signed a contract, they may choose to enter into a multiple offer situation. In this instance, the real estate agent typically advises the interested parties to present their best offer in writing in a sealed envelope. They may even advise that the buyers will not get an opportunity to amend their offer or to counteroffer, and hence the reason for submitting your best offer up front. The owner then opens each of the envelopes and makes their decision on which offer they are prepared to go with. If the agent didn't do it this way, it would turn into a Dutch auction, where buyers were effectively bidding against each other to secure the seller's acceptance. Definitely, this is a great position for the seller to be in, with multiple offers on the table. However, this is less desirable from our perspective as a buyer, because we do not have exclusivity to negotiate with the seller. This is the reality of making offers, though, and so you need to understand what is involved. 6. Backup contract. When a property is under contract with someone else, either because your offer was unsuccessful or because you didn't become aware of the property until it was under contract, there is still potential hope. In this situation, you can certainly advise the real estate agent that you want to put in a backup contract. This is a written contract with all your conditions complete, and it sits with the agent in anticipation of the first contract being unsuccessful and not proceeding to the unconditional phase. There are many reasons why this may happen, for example. They may pull out in the cooling off period, they may not get finance, or they may not be happy with the building and pest inspection, and the list goes on, depending on what clauses they included in their contract. The point is, your contract is next in line if the first falters. This is much more advantageous from your perspective than not having a backup contract in place, and the property is just going back on the open market. Once again, you have to compete against others to get your offer accepted. So for properties that you are serious about, a backup contract may be the difference between you getting the deal or not. Buying at auction. When buying at auction, you are making an unconditional offer. There is no cooling off period and you are agreeing to the terms of the auction, which is typically 10% deposit payable on the fall of the hammer on the day, and either a 30 or 60 day settlement. This means that all of your due diligence needs to have been done in advance of the auction date, including building and pest inspection, financial review to ensure that the bank will finance the purchase, bank valuation, town planner assessment, etc. Clearly, there is much more pressure bidding at auction for this very reason. It is unconditional, and hence there is no tolerance for you getting your research wrong, because there is no easy way out of getting out of settlement. The only exception to this is forfeiting your deposit, which at auction is typically 10% of the purchase price, and this is a sizable amount of money to lose. You can request to negotiate the terms of the auction, but this must be done in advance of the auction, and the seller must agree to the amendment. You will generally only be able to negotiate on the duration to settlement, for example, 60 days instead of the standard 30 days, and on the deposit amount payable on the drop of the hammer. It is unlikely that you will be able to negotiate on conditions that would make the sale conditional. The uniqueness of an auction is that it is unconditional on the fall of the hammer. Submitting an offer prior to auction is certainly another tactic worth considering. This is generally more successful the earlier you do it in the auction campaign. The reason some buyers will submit an offer prior to auction is because if the offer goes unconditional prior to the auction date, the seller is confident that they have an unconditional contract before cancelling the auction. For this reason, making an offer in the week of the auction is likely to be less successful. If a property is passed in at auction and not sold under the hammer, it is the highest bidder that gets first opportunity to negotiate with the seller post-auction. Offers at this point are back under standard contract terms, and hence you can negotiate conditional clauses if required. If you are interested in the property, it is definitely worth staying back after the auction. Remember, though, that there may be multiple parties waiting in the wings that are hoping they can negotiate post-auction too, because they were unable to negotiate under auction terms. Maybe they need a finance clause or some other condition to be able to proceed. For this reason, many properties get sold within a couple of weeks of post-auction. There are tactics involved when bidding at an auction, but most come down to your personal preference, including where do you stand? Next to the auctioneer, in front of the auctioneer, or at the back? When do you start bidding? Early on or right at the very end? In what increments do you bid? Small price increases or large increases? Do you have someone bid on your behalf, in person or over the phone? Do you engage with the agents assisting the auction, or do you go it alone? Regardless of what your auction tactics are, the bottom line is that you are very clear from the outset what your price limit is and that you do not go beyond it. Auctions are very emotional events, and this is what the auctioneer and agent are relying on. They want two or more emotional bidders bidding against each other to drive up the price. It's very easy to get swept up in this emotion, so be prepared for this, know your limit, and have a plan in place as to how you will stick to it. Buying off the plan. Buying off the plan is the process you enter into when purchasing a property that has not yet been created. It physically may not yet have been created in that it has not been built, or for land, it may not yet have been physically subdivided. Alternatively, the property may exist, but has not yet had titles issued, in which case a settlement cannot happen. Clearly, the due diligence involved in an off-the-plan purchase is greater than a normal purchase, and it is significantly magnified when the property does not yet physically exist. This is because you don't have the finished product to inspect, and you are entering a purchase contract purely on the strength of the documentation included in the contract. The key documents involved in an off-the-plan purchase contract that need to be reviewed include standard purchase contract, including all the terms detailed above in the contract, for example, deposit amount, settlement time frame, finance condition, etc. Disclosure statement, including plans of the property, for example, building approved plans, build specification, for example, finishes and fixtures, draft title plans, draft body corporate documents, if relevant. These documents are prepared by the seller, and hence the terms and conditions are set out by the seller and are typically in their favour, for example, deposit amount, settlement time frame, etc. These items are negotiable, however, so be confident to negotiate on the terms of the contract. Given the complexity of this style of purchase, it is imperative that your solicitor reviews the off-the-plan contract so that you understand exactly what you are signing and the implication of the terms. Be mindful that there are unique characteristics with buying off the plan, and these need to be taken into account. Some of these include: a sunset clause is likely to exist in the contract, which allows the seller to not proceed with the sale under certain circumstances, for example, development not commenced within a certain time frame. Bank finance approval only generally remains valid for up to 3 months. Therefore, if settlement is likely to be beyond this time frame, there is no guarantee the bank will finance the purchase come settlement. A second valuation is likely once titles are issued. However, if the market has moved backwards in that time, the valuation may not come in at contract price, and you may have to tip in extra cash. Also, the rental market may move over time, and this may affect the quality of the deal and the bank's financing. Obviously, the market value and rental rate may also move in your favour over the duration of the contract, and you actually benefit from this positive movement. It's this positive expectation that motivates off-the-plan purchases. Deposit for off-the-plan purchase is typically 10% and is generally payable early within the contract period, for example in 30 days subject to finance approval. This deposit amount is significantly higher than a normal deposit amount, hence you need higher cash reserves up front. Also, the amount is often not negotiable by the seller. This is because in many cases, it's not the seller that is dictating this deposit amount, it's the seller's development finance bank. They require the seller to achieve a certain number of pre-sales before they will begin funding the development, and they will specify the terms of a qualifying pre-sale. A 10% deposit is typical because that way the bank knows that they hold a sizable deposit, given that settlement may be a year or two in the future in some cases, and so a higher deposit is a larger incentive to ensure settlement occurs. For example, on a $400,000 purchase, $40,000 is payable as a 10% deposit, which is a large amount to forfeit if you don't proceed to settlement for whatever reason. What is negotiable, however, is whether you receive any interest on this money, given that it will typically be held in trust by the seller's solicitor and invested in an interest-earning term deposit. Submitting an offer on an off-the-plan property is a relatively simple process, generally involving you completing an expression of interest form. This is a form supplied by the seller's agent which details the standard terms of the contract. A nominal holding deposit of, say, $1,000 is often payable on submitting your expressions of interest, and this then holds your chosen property while the seller's solicitor draws up the off-the-plan contract specific to you. Typically, the holding deposit is fully refundable in the event that you change your mind or do not go unconditional on the purchase. Negotiation on the purchase. Negotiating on the purchase of a property is no different from any other negotiation in that there is generally a trade-off between the parties involved in order to arrive at a win-win situation where all parties are prepared to proceed. The fundamentals of negotiation are outlined in much more detail later in this module. Below, however, are a couple of points specific to negotiating on your initial purchase offer. Know your bottom line before starting negotiations. This was touched on early in this section, but is not to be undervalued. In the excitement and sometimes stress of a negotiation, it is easy to lose sight of what it was that you were trying to achieve at the outset and what your bottom line was. So pre-plan for this by writing down your preferred outcome, your must-have conditions, and those that you are prepared to negotiate on and that you may need to have up your sleeve if they counteroffer. Negotiate on terms or price, but generally not both. This comment often holds true when you are negotiating hard for large discounts. For example, if your offer is well below asking price, you may be pushing your luck to also request a long settlement, particularly if the seller wants a quick settlement. Conversely, if you are negotiating for a long settlement, for example 6 months, the seller may be less willing to negotiate on price. Clearly, this all depends on the strength of the market and the motivation of the seller. If the market is very strong, hence it's a seller's market, and properties are going under contract quickly, then clearly this is a very different environment from when property is sitting on the market a very long time, that is, when it's a buyer's market, and hence you may be able to be much more aggressive in your negotiations and negotiate hard on both terms and price. Similarly, if the seller is not in any rush to sell and they are willing to wait, then they are likely to be less willing to negotiate than someone who is under financial pressure or personal pressure and who needs a quick sale. In this case, everything is negotiable. Meet in the middle. a very successful negotiation technique when both parties have already negotiated back and forth for a bit and are still not in agreement is to suggest to meet in the middle. For example, if your last offer was $440,000 and their counter offer was $450,000, you may suggest to meet in the middle at $445,000. Similarly, if you want a 90-day settlement and they counter offered at 45-day settlement, maybe you offer to meet in the middle at, say, 65 days. If you plan to use this technique, then you do want to pre-plan your counter offers accordingly so that you start at a point that allows you still room to meet in the middle and end up at a point that was within your desired range. Timing is everything. When negotiating an offer, time is a very interesting tool. It can be both your friend and your foe. If you are playing hardball in your negotiations, then maybe you would leave some time in between you responding to the seller's counteroffer in an attempt to play hard to get, so to speak, and to come across less desperate to do the deal. This obviously can work against you, though, if the market is strong, because a delay in your reply can allow another buyer in on the act. Depending on the nature of the deal, the strength of the market, and your level of motivation to get it off the market, your response time may differ. Finally, the stability of the seller also needs to be taken into account, because with time, there is the potential that their situation may change. They may become more motivated, or they may become less motivated, and in fact decide to take the property off the market for whatever reason. Realize you are playing with fire if you are going to lag in your response time. Generally speaking, time is of the essence in negotiations, because you just never know what is around the corner. Contract process. Once agreement has been reached with your offer, either in writing or verbally, the next stage is to formally enter into a contract. If your negotiations have been verbal up to that point, then you need to get them on paper ASAP before anyone changes their mind. If there is a real estate agent involved, they will prepare the contract. If it is a private sale, then generally it's the seller's solicitor that draws it up. If it was an off-the-market property and you approach the owner, then it may be your solicitor that draws up the contract. Again, different states have different processes, so you need to be in contact with your solicitor ahead of time to ensure you understand the process in your state. If your offer was presented on contract, then your negotiations were likely to be by way of crossing out items on the written contract, amending your offer, and initialing the changes. Every change must be initialed by the person that made it, and then once agreement is reached, the final changes need to be initialed by all, buyer and seller. It is for this reason that some contracts may have a number of purchase prices handwritten and then crossed out and initialed. Signing the contract. What is essential is that the contract is signed by all parties ASAP, because unless it is signed, it is not a valid contract, and someone else could take the property from you. For this reason, time is of the essence and all parties should be working to this effect, including the real estate agent and the solicitors. It is always a little concerning when an agent is happy for a buyer to sign the contract early next week or a seller to sign it in the next couple of days. This is always a red flag because things can change very quickly. A sign of a great real estate agent is one that will drive to the buyer or seller at 9 p.m. at night to get a contract signed. That is the level of urgency that should be shown if you are serious about the property. If the agent or solicitor isn't working with that level of intensity, then maybe you need to be clear with them what your expectations are and that this is an important property transaction for you. Deposit payment. Once the contract is signed, you need to pay the deposit amount to the real estate agent in line with the contract, if it is not yet already paid. If there is no real estate agent involved, it generally gets paid to the solicitor that prepared the contract and is held in trust for the duration of the contract. Solicitor review. Prior to signing the contract, it is advisable to have your solicitor review it and provide you feedback so that you understand what you are about to sign. Insurance. In some states, once a purchase contract is signed, you then take on the liability of the property, and therefore building insurance should be put in place to cover damage from things like fire, storm, etc. Queensland is a prime example of this. In addition to building insurance, a small level of contents insurance should also be put in place to cover non-fixtures like floor coverings, blinds, external air conditioning units, etc. Make the insurance effective immediately. With some insurers, you can take out a cover note that gives you 30 days to pay. New South Wales specifics. As mentioned above in the due diligence section, purchasing a property in New South Wales is different from the rest of the country. In New South Wales, the exchange of contracts is an unconditional process. This means that prior to this point, even though your offer may have been verbally agreed by the seller, and you may even have had written confirmation from the agent to this effect, it is in fact not exclusively your property, and the seller can change their mind and ultimately sell to someone else. This is called being gazumped, where your offer is accepted, but you don't end up being the final purchaser. This practice can be common in New South Wales, particularly in a strong market or with a highly desirable property. The only traditional way of avoiding it is to exchange contracts as soon as possible, which means the seller signs a copy of the purchase contract and the buyer signs another copy, and the two contracts are then exchanged to be countersigned, hence the term exchanging contracts. Clearly, you need to be very confident that you are ready and able to purchase at the point of exchanging contracts, because on exchange the contract is unconditional. Hence, you will want to have had finance pre-approved, done a building and pest inspection, and conducted your due diligence. There are a couple of tricks of the trade used by property-specific lawyers to try to bring in a level of flexibility when entering into a contract in New South Wales, as listed below. These are not regularly used in the market by the general public, and so are less well understood by sellers and agents. For this reason, having a good property solicitor working for you is invaluable, so that they can educate the seller and the agent in this regard. Extending the cooling off period. The cooling off period is typically 5 days. However, this can be open to negotiation, and so you could request a longer cooling off period, for example 30 days, to give you time to complete your due diligence, that is, confirm finance, valuation, building and pest, etc. This does come at a cost, however, because terminating a contract based on the cooling off clause means that you forfeit 0.25% of the purchase price. This comes out of the deposit that you paid and goes to the seller to compensate them for taking the property off the market for a period of time. Enter into an option contract. An option contract is a legal contract where you, the buyer, is given the right to purchase the property, but not the obligation. Hence, it effectively gives you control of the property and therefore exclusivity to undertake your due diligence, while retaining the option not to proceed if you don't choose to. Options are a very valuable tool beyond the purpose being described here for New South Wales. Hence, they are covered in more detail later in this module. Conditional period. Once you have successfully entered into a contract that has conditions to fulfil and both parties have countersigned the contract, you are now in the conditional period of the contract. Below are a number of factors to consider during this period and actions to take. Building and pest inspection. If you do not already have a building and pest inspector, don't necessarily take the real estate agent's recommendation. They have a vested interest to work with inspectors that are more easygoing and may not really be working in your best interest. Ask to look at a sample report from inspectors before making your decision. The more photos, the better. Also, ask if they are okay with you attending the inspection. It is very worthwhile for you to attend the inspection and talk to the inspector or inspectors directly, because they are able to show you any issues and you are able to glean much more information. For example, ask them how serious the issue is, how long until it needs to be attended to, the potential cost to repair, etc. Remember, though, that things often sound worse in a report than they may actually be, hence the value of asking more questions. For example, you may be told the roof is in average condition and needs to be replaced. Through further questions, you may actually find out that there are just pinholes in the roof sheeting and they could be temporarily filled and the roof is likely to last another 5 years or so. This new information that you have gleaned from asking questions changes the whole urgency of the roof needing to be replaced. Certainly, you would not necessarily alert the seller to this, and instead you may choose to use the roof replacement issue in the building inspection report as a reason to renegotiate on the contract price of the property. It is your decision whether you request that the seller attends to correcting major items in the building and pest report prior to settlement, or it may be that you negotiate a discount on the purchase price. Obviously, there is no guarantee that the seller will agree to this. You need to decide your position and whether the issues raised are significant enough for you to terminate the contract if the seller will not agree to repair or compensate you. Whatever your decision, you need to advise your solicitor as a matter of priority regarding the satisfaction or not of the building and pest inspection, because they need to respond to the seller within the period specified in the contract for this condition, for example, 7 days. Finance approval. It is essential to provide your mortgage broker with a copy of the signed purchase contract so that they can formally get finance approval underway. Highlight to them the duration of the finance clause period so that they are clear on the time frame they have. Also, provide a very clear description to your broker about your intentions with the property, for example, buy, subdivide, build, sell, as this impacts on the choice of lender and the way the loan may be structured. If the property is tenanted, and for each tenanted area, provide a copy of the lease to confirm the rental amount and terms. If it is vacant, obtain 2 or 3 rental appraisal letters from local property managers and provide the highest or most favourable to your broker to submit to the bank. If there has been a lapse in time since you provided your broker with your pay slips and bank statements, etc., provide your most recent copies. Due diligence clauses. Where you have due diligence clauses in your contract, now is the time to get this research completed so that you are in a position to make a decision on them by the date set out in the contract. Depending on what special conditions you put into the contract, this might include getting quotes for renovation works, getting a survey plan done, having a soil test completed, attending a council pre-lodgement meeting, confirming existing buildings are council approved, completing due diligence on the body corporate, etc. Continue general due diligence. Your general due diligence on the property continues during the conditional period, including continually updating your detailed feasibility analysis, ordering a house connection plan to know where the sewer and drains traverse the site, investigating site constraints, etc. Solicitor searches. Your solicitor will give you the option for them to undertake a series of legal searches on the property, for example, main road search to confirm if there are any resumption plans in place, contaminated site search, heritage register search, etc. They will give you the option of having these searches completed before or after the contract goes unconditional. Definitely ensure you have these searches done during the conditional period so that if there are any issues with the search results, you are able to negotiate on them before the contract is unconditional and it's too late. Yes, this means spending some money on these searches before you know that you are unconditional on the property, but this needs to be considered as a cost of doing business and undertaking due diligence, and in reality, it's a relatively small cost to ensure you have options. Title insurance. Your solicitor may also give you the option to take out title insurance. This is a policy that protects against claims for various unknown and disclosed known risks that threaten ownership and use, including structures, of a property until its resale. A typical policy protects against the following risks, which commonly result in claims: illegal building works or structures, incorrect signature of a document resulting in potential problems with the registration of the transfer, forgery, fraud, duress, incompetency, incapacity or impersonation prior to settlement, mortgage or title fraud after settlement, for example, a third party takes out a mortgage over the purchased property without the purchaser knowing, defective registration of a document, lack of rights of access or use of services, breach of covenants, boundary issues such as an encroachment by or on to the insured property. This is definitely an invaluable tool to give you peace of mind in knowing that if you have missed anything in your due diligence on the property title, there is a fallback. Notifying the solicitor. Keeping in close contact with your solicitor during the conditional period is important. You need to notify your solicitor in advance of each clause date so that they are clear about your intentions. For example, with the finance clause, has this condition been fulfilled? Do you have finance approval, or are you prepared to waive this condition and proceed without approval? Do you intend to request a further time extension for finance, or negotiate in some other way, or terminate the contract based on this condition? In many states, time is of the essence with contracts and condition dates, and hence they need to be closely adhered to. opportunity to negotiate contract conditions. If your due diligence has revealed certain unexpected issues with the property, you may consider renegotiating with the seller to either have them resolve the issue or further discount the purchase price or extend the settlement duration. For example, the building and pest inspection may have raised issues, or your quotes may reveal that the renovation works will be too expensive given the condition of the property, or there may be encroachment on the boundary that needs resolving, or the costs to subdivide are too high to make the deal viable, etc. You need to commence this negotiation within the time period allowed in the contract for that clause, for example, within the 14 days of your building and pest inspection clause. Liaise closely with your solicitor to develop a game plan as to how you intend to respond to the seller. Your solicitor will then liaise directly with the seller's solicitor to start negotiations. If there is a real estate agent involved, as a matter of courtesy, it's suggested that you advise the agent in advance of the solicitor formally advising the seller. This keeps the agent in the loop, which they appreciate, and allows them to notify the seller and possibly start the negotiations and bring the seller around to your offer. Sometimes people respond better when hearing it from the agent, who they have been working with up to that point, rather than hearing it from their solicitor. Extension request. Discuss with your solicitor in advance if you need to request an extension on the conditional period. For example, if you need to extend the finance clause because your finance is not yet approved, or if you need to extend the building and pest inspection clause if you are not satisfied with the results and still making investigations, or if you need to extend the council DA approval clause, if you have one, because DA has not yet been issued. Your solicitor will notify the seller's solicitor and negotiate the extension request. Once again, it is recommended that you keep the real estate agent in the loop. Regarding the timing of this negotiation, it is recommended that you wait until the day that the condition is due to liaise with the seller's solicitor. This is so that it looks like you are doing everything possible to fulfil the condition in the period specified. Remember that it is at the discretion of the seller as to whether they agree to an extension or not, depending on their position and the strength of the market. For example, if the seller is looking for a reason to get out of the contract, this may be just the opportunity, so you need to be mindful of this. Likewise, if it is a strong market, the seller may believe they can now get a higher price, or maybe there is already a better backup contract sitting there waiting in case yours doesn't go unconditional. When requesting a time extension, it is recommended to err on the side of caution and request for more time than you think you will actually need, so that you do not have to request another extension. That is, if the finance clause is due today and you are told by the bank that they are only one day away from giving formal approval, it is recommended that you request a 7-day extension just to be safe. Remember that you can always fulfill the condition ahead of time if desired. Also, do not leave this negotiation until late in the day, for example 4 p.m, because if the seller can't be contacted in time for whatever reason, then you may be in a predicament. Terminating contract during cooling off period. If you decide that you do not want to proceed with the purchase for whatever reason, and it's still within the cooling off period in the contract, you may choose to utilise this condition. You need to be aware, however, that there may be a penalty cost in doing this. For example, in Queensland, the purchaser forfeits 0.25% of the contract price, which goes to the seller to compensate them for the loss of sale. Terminating the contract based on this condition does not require you to provide a reason or justification for the termination, just as long as it is within the allowed time period. Speak with your solicitor regarding the intention to terminate, because there may be other ways to terminate that may not trigger a penalty fee. Terminating contract post-cooling off period and based on contract conditions. Generally, you can only pull out of a contract and terminate post the cooling off period based on non-fulfillment of conditions in contract. For example, finance declined, unsatisfactory building and pest, soil test, solicitor review, etc. Be aware that you may need to show evidence that finance has been formally declined or that the building and pest inspection is not satisfactory, etc. Discuss this in advance with your solicitor so that you know what the process involves. If you do not intend to terminate, this is formally done through your solicitor, who notifies the seller's solicitor. Again, as a matter of courtesy, call the real estate agent to give them the heads up so that they can liaise with the seller. Unconditional period. Once you have successfully fulfilled the conditions of a contract, or you have chosen to waive them and your solicitor has notified the seller in writing, then the contract moves into the unconditional period. This now means that you are proceeding to settlement and cannot pull out of the contract. Below are a number of factors to consider during this period and actions to take. Notify the mortgage broker. Notify your broker as soon as possible that the contract has gone unconditional so that the bank can start preparing the mortgage documents. Mortgage documents. On receipt of the mortgage documents, read and review them to ensure all details are correct and that you understand the conditions. Things to check include the purchasing entity details, the security property address, to ensure that the bank is not cross-securitizing you, the loan term duration, the interest rate, the interest-only period, etc. Once you are satisfied that all details are correct, sign and return the documents to the bank as a matter of priority. If this means driving 100 kilometres to hand-deliver the documents, then sometimes that is what is needed to ensure that the settlement is not held up. Depending on the bank and the purchasing entity, the bank may also require you to seek independent legal advice prior to signing the loan documents. This may mean a different solicitor from the one assisting you with the settlement, so ask this question and plan this in advance so that it doesn't cause delays. Commence strategy. Use the unconditional period to your advantage and continue your due diligence and commence your strategy where possible. This may mean drafting plans, having specialist reports completed, right through to lodging development approval. Or it may be ordering renovation materials or booking tradespeople, or even conducting site works if you negotiated early access to the property. Engage the property manager. If the property is currently tenanted or will come available to rent post-settlement, you need to be proactive to research and select a property manager. This may be the current property manager, or it may be someone else. Enter into the property management agreement as soon as possible. See Module 7 for details of the agreement. Funds to complete purchase. Ensure you have the funds to complete the purchase well in advance of settlement. For example, the bank may only be contributing 80% of the purchase price and you need to contribute the balance 20%. Liaise with your solicitor to know when they require the funds to complete and in what form they can accept it. In most instances, a bank check is what is required. Review draft settlement statement. Within the week of settlement, your solicitor will prepare a draft settlement statement. This document details the figures to complete settlement and makes adjustments for the deposit already paid. It will also make adjustments for bills that the owner may have already paid or that are coming due post-settlement, for example, rates, water, body corporate fees, if applicable. You need to review these figures to ensure they meet your expectations and also because they will confirm the exact amount that you need to provide for settlement and whether multiple bank checks are required and if so, who they are to be written out to, for example, the seller, the seller's bank, the seller's solicitor, counsel, etc. Stamp duty payment. Your solicitor will advise the amount of stamp duty payable and you will need to pay this in advance of settlement. In some states, for an additional fee, you can delay stamp duty payment until settlement. This may assist your cash flow, so discuss with your solicitor ahead of time. Extending settlement. If you are not ready in time for settlement for whatever reason, your solicitor will need to request an extension ahead of time, or vice versa. The seller may not be ready for settlement and a request for extension is lodged. It may be due to the bank not being ready to settle, or there may be a delay in the calculation of settlement figures, or transfer documents, or you paying settlement funds, etc. There is no requirement for the seller to grant an extension, however, and if they don't, this could result in you being in default of the contract, which is a serious position to be in. In most instances, though, an extension is granted as long as it is for a relatively short time period. The seller is in full right to negotiate on this, though, and may charge you money in order to compensate them for the extra hold costs that they will incur, plus legal costs, etc. Once again, liaising closely with your solicitor is essential over this period. Settlement. Inspect the property prior to settlement. It is essential that you inspect the property 1 or 2 days prior to settlement in order to ensure that everything is as expected. The property is presented as you expected. Furniture is or is not there, depending on what you negotiated. The tenants or owners have vacated if you are selling with vacant possession. or the tenants are still present if that is what you negotiated in the contract. If you cannot physically inspect yourself, you need to engage someone to do it for on your behalf, but not necessarily the real estate agent, because they have a vested interest in having it settle ASAP in order for them to get paid. Funds to complete. Provide your solicitor the funds to complete settlement as per their instructions. Once again, if you need to drive 100 kilometres to make this happen to ensure settlement is on time, then sometimes that's just what you have to do. Settlement complete. Your solicitor should call you within a short time of settlement being complete. Key pickup. At settlement, your solicitor should have been provided the keys to the property. You will need to arrange to pick them up yourself or to have someone else pick them up for you. If it is the property manager picking the keys up for you, ensure that they make a copy for themselves to keep and that they provide you with the original set.